Hachette Audio presents The Overlook, written by Michael Connolly and read by Len Carreyrou, featuring original music by Frank Morgan.
To the librarian who gave me To Kill a Mockingbird. Chapter 1. The call came at midnight. Harry Bosch was awake and sitting in the living room, in the dark. He liked to think that he was doing this because it allowed him to hear the saxophone better. By masking one of the senses, he accentuated another. But deep down, he knew the truth. He was waiting. The call was from Larry Gandel, his supervisor in Homicide Special. It was Bosch's first call out in the new job, and it was what he had been waiting for.
Harry, you up?
I'm up.
Who's that you got playing?
Frank Morgan, live at Jazz Standard in New York. That's George Cables you're hearing now on piano.
Sounds like all blues.
You nailed it.
Good stuff. I hate to take you away from it.
Bosch used the remote to turn the music off. What's the call, Lieutenant?
Hollywood wants you and Iggy to come out and take over a case. They've already caught three today and can't handle a fourth. This one also looks like it might become a hobby. It looks like an execution.
The Los Angeles Police Department had 17 geographic divisions, each with its own station and detective bureau, including a homicide squad. But the divisional squads were the first line and couldn't get bogged down on long-running cases. When a murder came with any sort of political, celebrity, or media attachment, it was usually shuttled down to Homicide Special, which operated out of the Robbery Homicide Division in Parker Center. Any case that appeared to be particularly difficult and time-consuming, that would invariably stay active like a hobby, would also be an immediate candidate for a Homicide Special. This was one of those.
Where is it? Bosch asked. Up on that overlook above the Mulholland Dam. You know the place?
Yeah, I've been up there. Bosch got up and walked to the dining room table. He opened a drawer designed for silverware and took out a pen and a small notebook. On the first page of the notebook, he wrote down the date and the location of the murder scene.
Any other details I should know? Bosch asked. Not a lot, Gandel said. Like I said, it was described to me as an execution. Two in the back of the head. Somebody took this guy up there and blew his brains out all over that pretty view.
Bosch let this register a moment before asking the next question. Do they know who the dead guy is?
The divisionals are working on it. Maybe they'll have something by the time you get over there. It's practically in your neighborhood, right?
Not too far.
Gandel gave Bosch more specifics on the location of the crime scene and asked if Harry would make the next call out to his partner.
Bosch said he would take care of it.
Okay, Harry, get up there and see what's what. Then call me and let me know. Just wake me up. Everybody else does.
Bosch thought it was just like a supervisor to complain about getting woken up to a person he would routinely wake up over the course of their relationship.
You got it, Bosch said.
Bosch hung up and immediately called Ignacio Ferras, his new partner. They were still feeling their way. Ferras was more than 20 years younger and from another culture. The bonding would happen, Bosch was sure, but it would come slowly. It always did. Ferras was awakened by Bosch's call, but became alert quickly and seemed eager to respond, which was good. The only problem was that he lived all the way out in Diamond Bar, which would put his ETA at the crime scene at least an hour off. Bosch had talked to him about it the first day they had been assigned as partners, but Ferras wasn't interested in moving. He had a family support system in Diamond Bar and wanted to keep it. Bosch knew that he would get to the crime scene well ahead of Ferras, and that would mean he would have to handle any divisional friction on his own. Taking a case away from the divisional squad was always a delicate thing. It was a decision usually made by supervisors, not by the homicide detectives on the scene. No homicide detective worth the gold trim on his badge would ever want to give away a case. That just wasn't part of the mission.
See you there, Ignacio, Bosch said. Harry, Ferris said. I told you, call me Iggy. Everybody does.
Bosch said nothing. He didn't want to call him Iggy. He didn't think it was a name that matched the weight of the assignment and mission. He wished that his partner would come to that realization and then stop asking him. Bosch thought of something and added an instruction, telling Ferris to swing by Parker Center on his way in and pick up the city car they were assigned. It would add minutes to his arrival time, but Bosch planned to drive his own car to the scene, and he knew he was low on gas. Okay, see you there, Bosch said, leaving names out. He hung up and grabbed his coat out of the closet by the front door. As he put his arms into it, he glanced at himself in the mirror on the inside of the door. At 56 years old, he was trim and fit, and could even stand to add a few pounds, while other detectives his age were getting round in the middle. In Homicide Special, there was a pair of detectives known as Crate and Barrel because of their widening dimensions. Bosch didn't have to worry about that. The gray had not yet chased all of the brown out of his hair, but it was getting close to victory. His dark eyes were clear and bright, and ready for the challenge awaiting him at the Overlook. In his own eyes, Bosch saw a basic understanding of homicide work, that when he stepped out the front door, he would be willing and able to go the distance, whatever that entailed, to get the job done. It made him feel as though he were bulletproof. He reached across his body with his left hand to pull the gun out of the holster on his right hip. It was a Kimber Ultra Carry. He quickly checked the magazine and the action, and then returned the weapon to its holster. He was ready. He opened the door. The lieutenant had not known a lot about the case, but he had been right about one thing. The crime scene was not far from Bosch's home. He dropped down to Cahuenga and then took Barm across the 101 freeway. From there, it was a quick run up Lake Hollywood Drive to a neighborhood of homes clustered on the hills surrounding the reservoir and the Mulholland Dam. They were expensive homes. He worked his way around the fenced reservoir, stopping only for a moment when he came upon a coyote in the road. The animal's eyes caught the headlights and glowed brightly. It then turned and sauntered slowly across the road, disappearing into the brush. It was in no hurry to get out of the way, almost daring Bosch to do something. It reminded him of his days on patrol when he saw the same challenge in the eyes of most of the young men he encountered on the street. After passing the reservoir, he took Tahoe Drive farther up into the hills and then connected with the eastern terminus of Mulholland Drive. There was an unofficial overlook of the city here. It was posted with no parking and overlook closed at dark signs, but these were routinely ignored at all hours of the day and night. Bosch pulled in behind the grouping of official vehicles, the forensics van and the coroner's wagon, as well as several marked and unmarked police cars. There was an outer perimeter of yellow police tape surrounding the crime scene, and inside this boundary was a silver Porsche Carrera, with its hood open. It had been sectioned off by more yellow tape, and this told Bosch that it was most likely the victim's car. Bosch parked and got out. A patrol officer assigned to the outer perimeter took down his name and badge number, 2997, and allowed him under the yellow tape. He approached the crime scene. Two banks of portable lights had been erected on either side of the body, which was in the center of a clearing that looked down upon the city. As Bosch approached, he saw forensics techs and coroner's people working on and around the body. A tech with a video camera was documenting the scene as well. Harry, over here. Bosch turned and saw Detective Jerry Edgar leaning against the hood of an unmarked detective cruiser. He had a cup of coffee in his hand and appeared to be just waiting. He pushed himself off the car as Bosch came over. Edgar had been Bosch's partner once, back when he had worked in Hollywood Division. Back then, Bosch was a team leader on the homicide squad. Now Edgar was in that position.
Been waiting on somebody from RHD, Edgar said. Didn't know it'd be you, man.
It's me.
You working this solo?
No, my partner's on the way.
Your new partner, right? I haven't heard from you since that mess over in Echo Park last year.
Yeah. So what do you have here?
Bosch didn't want to talk about Echo Park with Edgar.
with anyone, as a matter of fact. He wanted to stay focused on the case at hand. It was his first call-out since his transfer to Homicide Special. He knew there would be a lot of people watching his moves. Some of them would be people hoping he would fail. Edgar turned so that Bosch could see what was spread out on the trunk of the car. Bosch took out glasses and put them on as he leaned in close to look. There wasn't a lot of light, but he could see an array of evidence bags. The bags separately contained items taken from the body. These included a wallet, key ring, and a clip-on name tag. There was also a money clip with a thick fold of currency and a BlackBerry that was still on, its green light flashing and ready to transmit calls its owner would never make or receive. "The coroner's guy just gave me all of this," Edgar said. "They should be done with the body in about 10 minutes. Bosch picked up the bag containing the ID tag and angled it toward the light. It said St. Agatha's Clinic for Women. On it was a photograph of a man with dark hair and dark eyes. It identified him as Dr. Stanley Kent. He was smiling at the camera. Bosch noticed that the ID tag was also a swipe key that could open locked doors. "You talk to Kiz much?" Edgar asked. It was a reference to Bosch's former partner, who had transferred after Echo Park to a management job in the OCP, the Office of the Chief of Police. "Not too much, but she's doing fine." Bosch moved on to the other evidence bags and wanted to move the conversation away from Kiz Ryder and onto the case at hand. "Why don't you run down what you've got for me, Jerry?" he said.
"Happy to," Edgar said. "The stiff was found about an hour ago. As you can see from the signs out on the street, there is no parking up here and no loitering after dark. Hollywood always has a patrol swing by here a few times a night to chase looky-loos away. Keeps the rich locals up here happy. I am told that house over there is Madonna's, or it was." He pointed to a sprawling mansion about 100 yards from the clearing. The moonlight silhouetted a tower rising from the structure. The mansion's exterior was striped in alternating hues of rust and yellow, like a Tuscan church. It was on a promontory that afforded anyone looking through its windows a magnificent sweeping view of the city below. Bosch imagined the pop star up in the tower looking down on the city that lay at her command. Bosch looked back at his old partner, ready for the rest of the report. "The patrol car swings around about 11 and sees the Porsche with the front hood open. Engine's in the back of those Porsches, Harry. It means the trunk was open."
"Got it."
"Okay, so you knew that already. Anyway, the patrol car pulls up. They don't see anybody in or around the Porsche, so the two officers get out. One of them walks out into the clearing and finds our guy. He's face down and has two in the back of the head. An execution. Clean and simple."
Bosch nodded at the ID tag in the evidence bag. "And this is the guy? Stanley Kent?"
"Looks that way. The tag and the wallet both say he's Stanley Kent, 42 years old from just around the corner on Arrowhead Drive. We ran the plate on the Porsche and it comes back to a business called K&K Medical Physicists. I just ran Kent through the box and he came up pretty clean. He's got a few speeding tickets on the Porsche, but that's it. A straight shooter."
Bosch nodded as he registered all the information.
"You are going to get no grief from me taking over this case, Harry," Edgar said. "I got one partner in court this month, and I left my other one at the first scene we caught today, a three-bagger, with a fourth victim on life support at Queen of Angels."
Bosch remembered that Hollywood ran its homicide squad in three-man teams instead of the traditional partnerships. "Any chance the three-bagger is connected to this?" He pointed to the gathering of technicians around the body on the overlook.
"Now, that's a straight gang shoot-'em-up," Edgar said. "I think this thing is a whole different ballgame, and I'm happy for you to take it."
"Good," Bosch said. "I'll cut you loose as soon as I can. Anybody look in the car yet?"
"Not really. Waiting on you."
"Okay. Anybody go to the victim's house on Arrowhead?"
"No on that, too."
"Anybody knock on any doors?"
"Not yet. We were working the scene first."
Edgar obviously had decided early that the case would be passed to RHD. It bothered Bosch that nothing had been done, But at the same time, he knew it would be his and Ferris's to work fresh from the start, and that wasn't a bad thing. There was a long history in the department of cases getting damaged or bungled while in transition from divisional to downtown detective teams. He looked at the lighted clearing and counted a total of 5 men working on or near the body for the forensics and coroner's teams. "Well," he said, "since you're working the crime scene first, did anybody look for foot impressions around the body before you let the techs approach?" Bosch couldn't keep the tone of annoyance out of his voice.
"Harry," Edgar said, his tone now showing annoyance with Bosch's annoyance. "A couple hundred people stand around on this overlook every damn day. We could have been looking at footprints till Christmas if we'd wanted to take the time." "I didn't think we did. We had a body laying out here in a public place and needed to get to it. Besides that, it looks like a professional hit. That means the shoes, the gun, the car, everything's already long gone by now."
Bosch nodded. He wanted to dismiss this and move on. "Okay," he said evenly. "Then I guess you're clear." Edgar nodded and Bosch thought he might be embarrassed.
"Like I said, Harry, I didn't expect it to be you."
Meaning he would not have dogged it for Harry, only for somebody else from RHD. "Sure," Bosch said. "I understand." After Edgar left, Bosch went back to his car and got the maglite out of the trunk. He walked back to the Porsche, put on gloves, and opened the driver's side door. He leaned into the car and looked around. On the passenger seat was a briefcase. It was unlocked, and when he popped the snaps, it opened to reveal several files, a calculator, and various pads, pens, and papers. He closed it and left it in its place. Its position on the seat told him that the dead man had likely arrived at the Overlook by himself. He had met his killer here. He had not brought his killer with him. This, Bosch thought, might be significant. He opened the glove box next, and several more clip-on IDs, like the one found on the body, fell to the floorboard. He picked them up, one by one, and saw that each access badge had been issued by a different local hospital. But the swipe cards all bore the same name and photo: Stanley Kent, the man who was lying dead in the clearing, Bosch presumed. He noticed that on the back of several of the tags there were handwritten notations. He looked at these for a long moment. Most were numbers with the letters L or R at the end, and he concluded that they were lock combinations. Bosch looked farther into the glove box and found even more IDs and access keycards. As far as he could tell, the dead man, if he was Stanley Kent, had clearance access to just about every hospital in Los Angeles County. He also had the combinations to security locks at almost every one of the hospitals. Bosch briefly considered that the IDs and key cards might be counterfeits used by the victim in some sort of hospital scam. Bosch returned everything to the glove box and closed it. He then looked under and between the seats and found nothing of interest. He backed out of the car and went to the open trunk. The trunk was small and empty, but in the beam of his flashlight, he noted that there were 4 indentations in the carpet lining the bottom. It was clear that something square and heavy, with 4 legs or wheels, had been carried in the trunk. Because the trunk was found in the open position, it was likely that the object, whatever it was, had been taken during the killing. "Detective?" Bosch turned and put the beam of his light into the face of a patrolman. It was the officer who had taken his name and badge number at the perimeter. He lowered the light. "What is it?"
"There's an FBI agent here. She's asking permission to enter the crime scene."
"Where is she?"
The officer led the way back to the yellow tape. As Bosch got close, he saw a woman standing next to the open door of a car. She was alone, and she wasn't smiling. Bosch felt the thud of uneasy recognition hit his chest. "Hello, Harry," she said when she saw him.
"Hello, Rachel," he said. Chapter 2. It had been almost 6 months since he had seen Special Agent Rachel Walling of the Federal Bureau of Investigation.
As he approached her at the tape, Bosch was sure that not a day had gone by in that time when he hadn't thought about her. He had never imagined, however, that they would be reunited, if they ever were reunited, in the middle of the night at a murder scene. She was dressed in jeans, an Oxford shirt, and a dark blue blazer. Her dark hair was unkempt, but she still looked beautiful. She obviously had been called in from home, just as Bosch had. She wasn't smiling, and Bosch was reminded of how badly things had ended the last time.
"Look," he said, "I know I've been ignoring you, but you didn't have to go to all the trouble of tracking me down at a crime scene just to..."
"It's not really a time for humor," she said, cutting him off, "if this is what I think it might be." They'd last had contact on the Echo Park case. He had found her at the time working for a shadowy FBI unit called Tactical Intelligence. She had never explained what exactly the unit did, and Bosch had never pushed it, since it wasn't important to the Echo Park investigation. He had reached out to her because of her past tenure as a profiler and their past personal history. The Echo Park case had gone sideways, and so had any chance for another romance. As Bosch looked at her now, he knew she was all business, and he had a feeling he was about to find out what the Tactical Intelligence Unit was all about.
"What is it you think it might be?" he asked.
"I'll tell you when I can tell you. Can I please see the scene?"
Reluctantly, Bosch lifted the crime scene tape and returned her perfunctory attitude with his standard sarcasm. "Come on in, then, Agent Walling," he said. "Why don't you just make yourself at home?"
She stepped under and stopped, at least respecting his right to lead her to his crime scene. "I actually might be able to help you here," she said. "If I can see the body, I might be able to make a formal identification for you."
She held up a file that she had been carrying down at her side.
"This way, then," Bosch said. He led her to the clearing, where the victim was cast in the sterilizing fluorescent light from the mobile units. The dead man was lying on the orange dirt about 5 feet from the drop-off at the edge of the overlook. Beyond the body and over the edge, the moonlight reflected off the reservoir below. Past the dam, the city spread out in a blanket of a million lights. The cool evening air made the light shimmer like floating dreams. Bosch put out his arm to stop Walling at the edge of the light circle. The victim had been rolled over by the medical examiner and was now face up. There were abrasions on the dead man's face and forehead, but Bosch thought he could recognize the man in the photos on the hospital tags in the glove box, Stanley Kent. His shirt was open, exposing a hairless chest of pale white skin. There was an incision mark on one side of the torso where the medical examiner had pushed a temperature probe into the liver.
"Evening, Harry," said Joe Felton, the medical examiner. "Or I guess I should say good morning.
Who's your friend there? I thought they teamed you with Iggy Ferris."
"I am with Ferris," Bosch responded. "This is Special Agent Walling from the FBI's Tactical Intelligence Unit."
"Tactical Intelligence? What will they think of next?"
"I think it's one of those Homeland Security-type operations. You know, don't ask, don't tell. That sort of thing."
"She says she might be able to confirm an ID for us."
Walling gave Bosch a look that told him he was being juvenile.
"All right if we come in, Doc?" Bosch asked.
"Sure, Harry. We're pretty much squared away here."
Bosch started to step forward, but Walling moved quickly in front of him and walked into the harsh light. Without hesitation, she took a position over the body. She opened the file and took out a color 8x10 face shot. She bent down and held it next to the dead man's face. Bosch stepped in close at her side to make a comparison himself.
"It's him," she said. "Stanley Kent."
Bosch nodded his agreement and then offered his hand to her so that she could step back over the body. She ignored it and did it without help. Bosch looked down at Felton, who was squatting next to the body.
"So, Doc, you want to tell us what we've got here?"
Bosch stooped down on the other side of the body to get a better look.
"We've got a man who was brought here or came here for whatever reason and was made to get down on his knees."
Felton pointed to the victim's pants.
There were smudges of orange dirt on both knees.
Then somebody shot him twice in the back of the head, and he went down face first. The facial injuries you see came when he hit the ground. He was already dead by then.
Bosch nodded.
No exit wounds,
Felton added.
Probably something small like a .22 with the ricochet effect inside the skull. Very efficient.
Bosch realized now that Lieutenant Gandil had been speaking figuratively when he mentioned that the victim's brains had been blown across the view from the overlook. He would have to remember Gandil's tendency toward hyperbole in the future. Time of death? He asked Felton.
Going by the liver temp, I would say 4 or 5 hours,
the medical examiner replied.
8 o'clock, give or take.
That last part troubled Bosch. He knew that by 8 it would have been dark, and all the sunset worshippers would have been long gone. But the 2 shots would have echoed from the overlook and into the houses on the nearby bluffs. Yet no one had made a call to the police, and the body wasn't found until a patrol car happened by 3 hours later.
I know what you're thinking, Felton said. What about the sound? There is a possible explanation. Guys, let's roll him back over.
Bosch stood up and stepped out of the way while Felton and one of his assistants turned the body over. Bosch glanced at Walling, and for a moment their eyes locked until she looked back down at the body. Turning the body had exposed the bullet entry wounds in the back of the head. The victim's black hair was matted with blood. The back of his white shirt was spattered with a fine spray of a brown substance that immediately drew Bosch's attention. He had been to too many crime scenes to remember a count. He didn't think that was blood on the dead man's shirt.
That's not blood, is it?
No, it's not, Felton said. I think we'll find out from the lab that it's good old Coca-Cola syrup,
the residue you might find in the bottom of an empty bottle or can.
Before Bosch could respond, Walling did. An improvised silencer. To dampen the sound of the shots, she said. You tape an empty plastic liter Coke bottle to the muzzle of the weapon, and the sound of the shot is significantly reduced as sound waves are projected into the bottle rather than the open air. If the bottle had a residue of Coke in it, the liquid would be spattered onto the target of the shot. Felton looked at Bosch and nodded approvingly.
Where'd you get her, Harry? She's a keeper.
Bosch looked at Walling. He, too, was impressed. Internet, she said. Bosch nodded, though he didn't believe her.
And there is one other thing you should note,
Felton said, drawing attention back to the body. Bosch stooped down again. Felton reached across the body to point at the hand on Bosch's side.
We have one of these on each hand.
He was pointing to a red plastic ring on the middle finger. Bosch looked at it and then checked the other hand. There was a matching red ring. On the inside of each hand, the ring had a white facing that looked like some sort of tape. What are they? Bosch asked.
I don't know yet, Felton said. But I think...
I do, Walling said. Bosch looked up at her. He nodded. Of course she knew.
They're called TLD rings, Walling said. Stands for Thermal Luminescent Dosimetry. It's an early warning device. It's a ring that reads radiation exposure.
The news brought an eerie silence to the gathering, until Walling continued. And I'll give you a tip, she said. When they are turned inward like that, with the TLD screen on the inside of the hand, that usually means the wearer directly handles radioactive materials.
Bosch stood up. Okay, everybody, he ordered. Back away from the body. Everybody just back away.
The crime scene techs, the coroner's people, and Bosch all started moving away from the body. But Walling didn't move. She raised her hands like she was calling for a congregation's attention in church.
Hold on, hold on, she said. Nobody has to back away. It's cool, it's cool. It's safe.
Everybody paused, but nobody moved back to their original positions.
If there was an exposure threat here, then the TLD screens on the rings would be black, she said. That's the early warning. But they haven't turned black, so we're all safe. Additionally, I have this.
She pulled back her jacket to reveal a small black box clipped to her belt like a pager.
"Radiation monitor," she explained. "If we had a problem, believe me, this thing would be screaming bloody murder and I'd be running at the front of the pack. But we don't. Everything is cool here, okay?"
The people at the crime scene hesitantly started to return to their positions. Harry Bosch moved in close to Walling and took her by an elbow.
"Can we talk over here for a minute?"
They moved out of the clearing toward the curb at Mulholland. Bosch felt things shifting, but tried not to show it. He was agitated. He didn't want to lose control of the crime scene, and this sort of information threatened to do just that.
"What are you doing here, Rachel?" he asked. "What's going on?"
"Just like you. I got a call in the middle of the night. I was told to roll out."
"That tells me nothing."
"I assure you that I am here to help."
"Then start by telling me exactly what you are doing here and who sent you out. That would help me a lot."
Walling looked around and then back at Bosch. She pointed out beyond the yellow tape.
"Can we?"
Bosch held out his hand, telling her to lead the way. They went under the tape and out into the street. When he judged that they were out of earshot of everyone else at the crime scene, Bosch stopped and looked at her.
"Okay, this is far enough," he said. "What is going on here?
Who called you out here?"
She locked eyes with him again. "Listen, what I tell you here has to remain confidential," she said, "for now."
"Look, Rachel, I don't have time for—"
"Stanley Kent is on a list. When you or one of your colleagues ran his name on the National Crime Index computer tonight, a flag went up in Washington, D.C., and a call went out to me at Tactical."
"What, was he a terrorist?"
"No, he was a medical physicist, and as far as I know, a law-abiding citizen."
"Then what's with the radiation rings and the FBI showing up in the middle of the night? What list was Stanley Kent on?"
Walling ignored the question.
"Let me ask you something, Harry. Has anyone checked on this man's home or wife yet?"
"Not yet. We were working the crime scene first. I plan to—"
"Then I think we need to do that right now," she said in an urgent tone. "You can ask your questions along the way. Get the guy's keys in case we need to go in, and I'll go get my car."
Walling started to move away, but Bosch caught her by the arm.
"I'm driving," he said.
He pointed toward his Mustang and left her there. He headed to the patrol car where the evidence bags were still spread on the trunk. As he made his way, he regretted having already cut Edgar loose from the scene. He signaled the watch sergeant over.
"Listen, I have to leave the scene to check on the victim's house. I shouldn't be gone long, and Detective Ferris should be here any minute. Just maintain the scene until one of us gets here."
"You got it."
Bosch pulled out a cell phone and called his partner.
"Where are you?"
"I just cleared Parker Center. I'm 20 minutes away."
Bosch explained that he was leaving the scene and that Ferris needed to hurry. He disconnected, grabbed the evidence bag containing the key ring off the cruiser's trunk, and shoved it into his coat pocket. As he got to his car, he saw Walling already in the passenger seat. She was finishing a call and closing her cell phone.
"Who was that?" Bosch asked after getting in.
"The president?"
"My partner," she replied. "I told him to meet me at the house."
"Where's your partner?"
"He's coming."
Bosch started the car. As soon as they pulled out, he started asking questions. If Stanley Kent wasn't a terrorist, then what list was he on?
"As a medical physicist, he had direct access to radioactive materials. That put him on a list."
Bosch thought of all the hospital name tags he had found in the dead man's Porsche.
"Access where? In the hospitals?"
"Exactly. That's where it's kept. These are materials primarily used in the treatment of cancer."
Bosch nodded. He was getting the picture, but still didn't have enough information.
"Okay, so what am I missing here, Rachel? Lay it out for me."
"Stanley Kent had direct access to materials that some people in the world would like to get their hands on. Materials that could be very, very valuable to these other people, but not in the treatment of cancer."
"Terrorists?"
"Exactly."
"Are you saying that this guy could just waltz into a hospital and get this stuff? Aren't there regulations?"
Walling nodded.
"There are always regulations, Harry, but just having them is not always enough. repetition, routine. These are the cracks in any security system. We used to leave the cockpit doors on commercial airlines unlocked. Now we don't. It takes an event of life-altering consequences to change procedures and strengthen precautions. Do you understand what I'm saying?
He thought of the notations on the back of some of the ID cards in the victim's Porsche. Could Stanley Kent have been so lax about the security of these materials that he wrote access combinations on the back of his ID cards?
Bosch's instincts told him the answer was probably yes.
I understand, he told Walling.
So then, if you were going to circumvent an existing security system, no matter how strong or weak, who would you go to?
She asked.
Bosch nodded. Somebody with intimate knowledge of that security system.
Exactly.
Bosch turned onto Arrowhead Drive and started looking at address numbers on the curb. So you were saying this could be an event of life-altering consequences?
No, I'm not saying that, not yet.
Did you know Kent? Bosch looked at Walling as he asked, and she looked surprised by the question. It had been a long shot, but he threw it out there for the reaction, not necessarily the answer. Walling turned from him and looked out her window before answering. Bosch knew the move, a classic tell. He knew she would now lie to him.
No, I never met the man.
Bosch pulled into the next driveway and stopped the car.
What are you doing?
She asked. This is it. It's Kent's house. They were in front of a house that had no lights on inside or out. It looked like no one lived there.
No, it isn't, Walling said. His house is down another block.
She stopped when she realized Bosch had smoked her out. Bosch stared at her for a moment in the dark car before speaking. You want to level with me now, or do you want to get out of the car?
Look, Harry, I told you there are things I can't...
Get out of the car, Agent Walling. I'll handle this myself.
Look, you have to understand...
This is a homicide. My homicide. Get out of the car. She didn't move.
I can make one phone call and you'd be removed from this investigation before you got back to the scene, she said.
Then do it. I'd rather be kicked to the curb right now than be a mushroom for the feds. Isn't that one of the Bureau's slogans? Keep the locals in the dark and bury them in cow shit? Well, not me. Not tonight. And not on my own case.
He started to reach across her lap to open her door. Walling pushed him back and raised her hands in surrender. All right, she said. What is it you want to know?
I want the truth this time. All of it. Chapter 3 Bosch turned in his seat to look directly at Walling. He was not going to move the car until she started talking.
You obviously knew who Stanley Kent was and where he lived, he said. You lied to me. Now, was he a terrorist or not?
I told you, no, and that is the truth. He was a citizen. He was a physicist. He was on a watch list because he handled radioactive sources which could be used in the wrong hands to harm members of the public.
What are you talking about? How would this happen?
Through exposure, and that could take many different forms. Individual assault. You remember last Thanksgiving, the Russian who was dosed with polonium in London? That was a specific target attack, though there were ancillary victims as well. The material Kent had access to could possibly be used on a larger scale as well. A mall, a subway, whatever. It all depends on the quantity and, of course, the delivery device.
Delivery device? Are you talking about a bomb? Somebody can make a dirty bomb with the stuff he handled?
In some applications, yes.
I thought that was an urban legend that there's never actually been a dirty bomb.
The official designation is IED, improvised explosive device. And put it this way, it's only an urban legend until precisely the moment that the first one is detonated.
Bosch nodded and got back on track. He gestured to the house in front of him. How did you know this isn't the Kent house? Walling rubbed her forehead as though she were tired of his annoying questions and had a headache.
Because I have been to his house before, okay? Early last year, my partner and I came to Kent's house and briefed him and his wife on the potential dangers of his profession. We did a security check on their home and told them to take precautions. We had been asked to do it by the Department of Homeland Security. Okay?
Yeah, okay.
And was that routine for the Tactical Intelligence Unit and the Department of Homeland Security, or was that because there had been a threat to him? Not a threat specifically aimed at him, no. Look, we're wasting...
Then to who? A threat to who?
Walling adjusted her position in the seat and let her breath out in exasperation. There wasn't a threat to anyone specifically. We were simply taking precautions. 16 months ago, someone entered a cancer clinic in Greensboro, North Carolina, circumvented elaborate security measures, and removed 22 small tubes of a radioisotope called cesium-137. The legitimate medical use of this material in that setting was in the treatment of gynecological cancer. We don't know who got in there or why, but the material was taken. When news of the theft went out on the wire, somebody in the Joint Terrorism Task Force here in L.A. thought it would be a good idea to assess the security of these materials in local hospitals and to warn those who have access to and handle the stuff to take precautions and to be alert. Can we please go now?
And that was you?
Yes, you got it. It was the federal trickle-down theory at work. It fell to me and my partner to go out and talk to people like Stanley Kent. We met him and his wife at their house so we could do a security check of the place at the same time we told him that he should start watching his back. That is the same reason I was the one who got the call when his name came up on the flag.
Bosch dropped the transmission into reverse and pulled quickly out of the driveway. Why didn't you just tell me this up front?
In the street, the car jerked forward as Bosch threw it into drive. Because nobody got killed in Greensboro, Walling said defiantly. This whole thing could be something different. I was told to approach with caution and discretion. I'm sorry I lied to you.
A little late for that, Rachel. Did your people get the cesium back in Greensboro?
She didn't answer.
Did you?
No, not yet. The word is that it was sold on the black market. The material itself is quite valuable on a monetary basis, even if used in the proper medical context. That's why we are not sure what we've got here. That's why I was sent.
In 10 more seconds, they were at the correct block of Arrowhead Drive, and Bosch started looking for address numbers again. But Walling directed him.
That one up on the left, I think, with the black shutters. It's hard to tell in the dark.
Bosch pulled in and chunked the transmission into park before the car had stopped. He jumped out and headed to the front door. The house was dark. Not even the light over the door was lit. But as Bosch approached the front door, he saw that it had been left ajar.
"It's open," he said.
Bosch and Walling drew their weapons. Bosch placed his hand on the door and slowly pushed it open. With guns up, they entered the dark and quiet house, and Bosch quickly swept the wall with his hand until he found a light switch. The lights came on, revealing a living room that was neat but empty, with no sign of trouble.
"Mrs. Kent?"
Walling called out loudly. Then to Bosch in a lower voice, she said, "There's just his wife, no children." Walling called out once more, but the house remained silent. There was a hallway to the right, and Bosch moved toward it. He found another light switch and illuminated a passageway with 4 closed doors and an alcove. The alcove was a home office that was empty. He saw a blue reflection on the window that was cast by a computer screen. They passed by the alcove and went door by door, clearing what looked like a guest bedroom and then a home gym with cardio machines and with workout mats hanging on the wall. The third door was to a guest bathroom that was empty, and the fourth led to the master bedroom. They entered the master, and Bosch once more flicked up a wall switch. They found Mrs. Kent. She was on the bed, naked, gagged and hogtied, with her hands behind her back. Her eyes were closed. Walling rushed to the bed to see if she was alive, while Bosch moved through the bedroom to clear the bathroom and a walk-in closet. There was no one. When he got back to the bed,
He saw that Walling had removed the gag and used a pocket knife to slice through the black plastic snap ties that had been used to bind the woman's wrists and ankles together behind her back. Rachel was pulling the bedspread over the unmoving woman's naked body. There was a distinct odor of urine in the room.
"Is she alive?" Bosch asked.
"She's alive. I think she's just passed out. She was left here like this."
Walling started rubbing the woman's wrists and hands. They had turned dark and almost purple from lack of blood circulation.
"Get help," she ordered.
Annoyed with himself for not reacting until ordered, Bosch pulled out his phone and walked out into the hallway while he called the Central Communications Center to get paramedics rolling.
10 minutes, he said after hanging up and coming back into the bedroom.
Bosch felt a wave of excitement go through him. They now had a live witness. The woman on the bed would be able to tell them at least something about what had happened. He knew that it would be vitally important to get her talking as soon as possible. There was a loud groan as the woman regained consciousness.
"Mrs. Kent, it's okay," Walling said. "It's okay. You're safe now."
The woman tensed, and her eyes widened when she saw the two strangers in front of her. Walling held up her credentials.
"FBI, Mrs. Kent. Do you remember me?"
"What? Where's my husband?"
She started to get up, but then realized she was naked beneath the bed covers and tried to pull them tightly around herself. Her fingers were apparently still numb and couldn't find purchase. Walling helped pull the spread around her.
"Where is Stanley?"
Walling knelt at the bottom of the bed so that she was on an equal level with her. She looked up at Bosch as if seeking direction on how to handle the woman's question.
"Mrs. Kent, your husband is not here," Bosch said. "I am Detective Bosch with the LAPD, and this is Agent Walling with the FBI. We're trying to find out what happened to your husband."
The woman looked up at Bosch and then at Walling, and her eyes held on the federal agent.
"I remember you," she said. "You came to the house to warn us. Is that what is happening? Do the men who were here have Stanley?"
Rachel leaned in close and spoke in a calming voice.
"Mrs. Kent, it's Alicia, right? Alicia, we need for you to calm down a little bit so that we can talk and possibly help you. Would you like to get dressed?"
Alicia Kent nodded.
"Okay, we'll give you some space here," Walling said. "You get dressed and we'll wait for you in the living room. First, let me ask, have you been injured in any way?"
The woman shook her head.
"Are you sure?"
Walling didn't finish, as though she were intimidated by her own question. Bosch wasn't. He knew they needed to know precisely what had happened here. "Mrs. Kent, were you sexually assaulted here tonight?" The woman shook her head again.
"They made me take off my clothes. That was all they did."
Bosch studied her eyes, hoping to read them and be able to tell if she was telling a lie.
"Okay," Walling said, interrupting the moment. "We'll leave you to get dressed. When the paramedics arrive, we will still want them to check you for injuries."
"I'll be fine,"
Alicia Kent said.
"What happened to my husband?"
"We're not sure what's happened," Bosch said. "You get dressed and come out to the living room. Then we'll tell you what we know." Clutching the bedspread around herself, she tentatively stood up from the bed. Bosch saw the stain on the mattress and knew that Alicia Kent had either been so scared during her ordeal that she had urinated, or the wait for rescue had been too long. She took one step toward the closet and appeared to be falling over. Bosch moved in and grabbed her before she fell.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fine. I think I'm just a little dizzy. What time is it?"
Bosch looked at the digital clock on the right side bed table, but its screen was blank. It was turned off or unplugged. He turned his right wrist without letting go of her and looked at his watch. "It's almost 1 a.m. Her body seemed to tighten in his grasp.
"Oh, my God,"
she cried.
"It's been hours. Where is Stanley?"
Bosch moved his hands to her shoulders and helped her stand up straight.
"You get dressed and we'll talk about it," he said.
She walked on steadily to the closet and opened the door. A full-length mirror was attached to the outside of the door. Her opening it swung Bosch's reflection back at him. In the moment, he thought that maybe he saw something new in his eyes, something not there when he had checked himself in the mirror before leaving his house. A look of discomfort, perhaps even a fear of the unknown. It was understandable, he decided. He had worked 1,000 murder cases in his time, but never one that had taken him in the direction he was now traveling. Maybe fear was appropriate. Alicia Kent took a white terry cloth robe off a hook on a wall inside the closet and carried it with her to the bathroom. She left the closet door open, and Bosch had to look away from his own reflection. Walling headed out of the bedroom, and Bosch followed. "What do you think?" she asked as she moved down the hall.
"I think we're lucky to have a witness," Bosch replied. "She'll be able to tell us what happened."
"Hopefully."
Bosch decided to make another survey of the house while waiting for Alicia Kent to get dressed. This time he checked the backyard and the garage as well as every room again. He found nothing amiss, though he did note that the two-car garage was empty. If the Kents had another car in addition to the Porsche, then it wasn't on the premises. Following the walkthrough, he stood in the backyard looking up at the Hollywood sign and calling Central Communications again to ask that a second forensics team be dispatched to process the Kent house. He also checked on the ETA of the paramedics coming to examine Alicia Kent and was told that they were still 5 minutes away. This was 10 minutes after he had been told that they were 10 minutes away. Next, he called Lieutenant Gamble, waking him at his home. His supervisor listened quietly as Bosch updated him. The federal involvement and the rising possibility of a terrorism angle to the investigation gave Gamble pause.
"Well," he said when Bosch was finished, "it looks like I will have to wake some people up."
He meant he was going to have to send word up the department ladder of the case and the larger dimensions it was taking on. The last thing an RHD lieutenant would want or need would be to get called into the OCP in the morning and asked why he hadn't alerted command staff earlier to the case and its growing implications. Bosch knew that Gamble would now act to protect himself as well as to seek direction from above. This was fine with Bosch, and expected, but it gave him pause as well. The LAPD had its own Office of Homeland Security. It was commanded by a man most people in the department viewed as a loose cannon, who was unqualified and unsuited for the job.
"Is one of those wake-ups going to Captain Hadley?" Bosch asked.
Captain Don Hadley was the twin brother of James Hadley, who happened to be a member of the Police Commission, the politically appointed panel with LAPD oversight, and the authority to appoint and retain the chief of police. Less than a year after James Hadley was placed on the commission by mayoral appointment and the approval of the city council, his twin brother jumped from being second in command of the Valley Traffic Division to being commander of the newly formed Office of Homeland Security. This was seen at the time as a political move by the then chief of police, who was desperately trying to keep his job. It didn't work. He was fired and a new chief appointed. But in the transition, Hadley kept his job commanding the OHS. The mission of the OHS was to interface with federal agencies and maintain a flow of intelligence data. In the last 6 years, Los Angeles had been targeted by terrorists at least 2 times that were known. In each incident, the LAPD found out about the threat after it had been foiled by the feds. This was embarrassing to the department, and the OHS had been formed so that the LAPD could make intelligence inroads and eventually know what the federal government knew about its own backyard. The problem was that in practice it was largely suspected that the LAPD remained shut out by the feds. And in order to hide this failing and to justify his position and unit, Captain Hadley had taken to holding grandstanding press conferences and showing up with his black-clad OHS unit at any crime scene where there was a remote possibility of terrorist involvement. An overturned tanker truck on the Hollywood Freeway brought the OHS out in force until it was determined that the tanker was carrying milk. A shooting of a rabbi at a temple in Westwood brought the same response until the incident was determined to have been the product of a love triangle. And so it went. After about the fourth misfire, the commander of the OHS was baptized with a new name among the rank and file. Captain Don Hadley became known as Captain Dun Badley. But he remained in his position, thanks to the thin veil of politics that hung over his appointment. The last Bosch had heard about Hadley through the department grapevine was that he had put his entire squad back into the academy for training in urban assault tactics.
"I don't know about Hadley," Gandalf said in response to Bosch. "He'll probably be looped in. I'll start with my captain, and he'll make the call on who gets the word from there. But that's not your concern, Harry. You do your job and don't worry about Hadley. The people you have to watch your back with are the feds."
"Got it."
"Remember, with the feds, it's always time to worry when they start telling you just what you want to hear."
Bosch nodded. The advice followed a time-honored LAPD tradition of distrusting the FBI. And, of course, it was a tradition honored for just as long by the FBI in terms of distrusting the LAPD right back. It was the reason the OHS was born. When Bosch came back into the house, he found Walling on her cell phone and a man he had never seen before, standing in the living room. He was tall, mid-40s, and he exuded that undeniable FBI confidence Bosch had seen many times before. The man put out his hand.
"You must be Detective Bosch," he said. "Jack Brenner. Rachel's my partner."
Bosch shook his hand. The way he said Rachel was his partner was a small thing, but it told Bosch a lot. There was something proprietary about it. Brenner was telling him that the senior partner was now on the job, whether that would be Rachel's view of it or not. "So, you two have met." Bosch turned. Walling was off the phone now. "Sorry," she said. "I was filling in the special agent in charge. He's decided to devote all of tactical to this. He's running out three teams to start hitting the hospitals to see if Kent has been in any of the hot labs today."
"The hot lab is where they keep the radioactive stuff?" Bosch asked.
"Yes. Kent had access through security to just about all of them in the county. We have to figure out if he was inside any of them today." Bosch knew that he could probably narrow the search down to one medical facility, St. Agatha's Clinic for Women. Kent was wearing an ID tag from the hospital when he was murdered. Walling and Brenner didn't know that, but Bosch decided not to tell them yet. He sensed the investigation was moving away from him, and he wanted to hold on to what might be the one piece of inside information he still had.
"What about the LAPD?" he asked instead.
"The LAPD?" Brenner said, jumping on the question ahead of Walling.
"You mean what about you, Bosch? Is that what you're asking?"
"Yeah, that's right. Where do I stand in this?"
Brenner spread his arms in a gesture of openness. "Don't worry, you're in. You're with us all the way."
The federal agent nodded like it was a promise as good as gold.
"Good," Bosch said. "That's just what I wanted to hear."
He looked at Walling for confirmation of her partner's statement, but she looked away. Chapter 4. When Alicia Kent finally came out of the master bedroom, she had brushed her hair and washed her face, but had put on only the white robe. Bosch now saw how attractive she was, small and dark and exotic-looking in some way. He guessed that taking her husband's name had hidden a bloodline from somewhere far away. Her black hair had a luminescent quality to it. It framed an olive face that was beautiful and sorrowful at the same time. She noticed Brenner, and he nodded and introduced himself. Alicia Kent seemed so dazed by what was happening that she showed no recognition of Brenner in the way that she had remembered Walling. Brenner directed her to the couch and told her to sit down.
"Where is my husband?"
she demanded, this time with a voice that was stronger and calmer than before.
"I want to know what is going on."
Rachel sat down next to her, ready to console if necessary. Brenner took a chair near the fireplace. Bosch remained standing. He never liked to be sitting down all cozy when he delivered this sort of news. "Mrs. Kent," Bosch said, taking the lead in a proprietary effort to keep his hold of the case. "I am a homicide detective. I am here because earlier tonight we found the body of a man we believe to be your husband. I am very sorry to tell you this." Her head dropped forward as she received the news. Then her hands came up and they covered her face. A shudder went through her body, and the sound of a helpless moan came from behind her hands. Then she started to cry. Deep sobs that shook her shoulders so much that she had to lower her hands to hold the robe from coming open. Walling reached over and put a hand on the back of her neck. Brenner offered to get her a glass of water, and she nodded. While he was gone, Bosch studied the woman and saw the tears streaking her cheeks. It was dirty work, telling someone that their loved one was dead. He had done it hundreds of times, but it wasn't something you ever got used to, or even good at. It had also been done to him. When his own mother was murdered more than 40 years before, he got the news from a cop just after